The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to From the Median, a daily report from the front line of the pro-life movement, discussing two worldviews that are driving our culture in opposite directions. From the Median asks, which side of the road are you on? What direction do you want our culture to go? Tune in as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. And now your host, Molly Smith.
This evening, we will continue our Bringing America Back to Life series. Tonight, we feature a presentation from our 2019 convention. We know that you will be inspired by the ideas, the principles, the experiences, and the wisdom of our speakers as they join us to pave the way back to life through prayer, action, voting, and education. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Ryan T. Anderson, the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation, as well as the founder and editor-in-chief of Public Discourse, which is an online journal of the Witherspoon Institute of Princeton University, New Jersey. He is the author of When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment, and The Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom. He is the co-author of What is Marriage? A Man and a Woman, a Defense. The title of his presentation tonight is Understanding and Responding to Our Transgender Moment.
Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you all for being here so early on a Friday morning. Who besides me is missing bacon this morning? The first Friday in Lent is always the hardest one, but it gets better. As Molly mentioned, 5 years ago, I was first here in 2014 to speak about what the proper definition of marriage is and what the consequences would be of the redefinition of marriage. And nowhere in that presentation did I mention anything about gender identity or transgender identities. 5 years ago, this wasn't a prime time conversation. In fact, the first prime time conversation about this took place the Friday night before the oral arguments in Obergefell, the Supreme Court case that redefined marriage everywhere. It was when Bruce Jenner, as he was then called, sat down for a two-hour 2020 interview. And what that suggested to me at the time, and which I think has now been confirmed in hindsight, is that activists on the left, they knew they were about to win with Anthony Kennedy at the Supreme Court, and they were planning to pivot from the LGB part of the acronym to the T part of the acronym, which is why marriage was redefined in June of 2015, and then in May of 2016, the word sex was redefined by the Obama administration to mean gender identity. And in those last months of the Obama administration, expecting that Hillary Clinton was about to win an election and continue their program, in those last months of the Obama administration, they issued a Dear Colleague letter that went out to all of the nation's schools saying that their bathrooms, their locker rooms, their sports teams, their showers, their dorm rooms, hotel rooms for field trips, all of those policies would have to be rewritten to be based on the subjective gender identity of a student rather than their objective biology. That very same day, the Department of Health and Human Services finalized a new Obamacare mandate that said all healthcare plans would have to pay for sex reassignment procedures and all relevant physicians would have to perform them. This was what was going on in those last months of the prior presidential administration. And I think what this shows us is I think it's the confluence of three different strains. There was a ideological strain that fed this. This is the outgrowth of the sexual revolution. What first started with the hookup culture, it then led to non-marital childbearing, then led to abortion, then led to the redefinition of marriage, is now just continuing to the redefinition of sex and gender with transgender identities. There's a certain logic of a train going down the tracks in the wrong direction. We keep going to destination after destination, and these are bad destinations. So one was this, the outgrowth of the sexual revolution and of bad ideology about the body and about sexuality. The second was new technology. 100 years ago, you couldn't attempt to reassign someone's sex. We didn't have synthetic testosterone to give to high school girls or synthetic estrogen to give to high school boys. And so part of this is the misuse, the abuse of technology and of new possibilities for technology. And then the last part, when you combine the ideology with the technology, what really kicked this off was political power. This is not a grassroots, groundswell populist movement. This is something that was imposed on the American people by ideologues in power in Washington, D.C. And in many state houses across the country, in many city halls, this isn't just happening from D.C., but it's that combination of political muscle who can force this on people, a new ideology about sexuality and the body, and the new technological possibilities, all of which, if detached from truth and goodness, can take us in very bad places. So what are the questions now being asked of Americans? We're asked to consider whether or not a boy could be trapped in a girl's body, whether or not sex is merely assigned to us at birth, whether or not doctors can reassign sex later in life. And to a certain extent, these should not be difficult questions. These should be questions that all of our grandparents would have no trouble answering. And when the medical establishment first started to go off the rails on these issues, Dr. Paul McHugh thought he had put an end to it. Dr. McHugh is a world-class psychiatrist, probably the best American psychiatrist of his generation. He was educated at Harvard College as an undergraduate. He then went to Harvard Medical School, and then he was hired by Johns Hopkins. He was hired originally just as a staff psychiatrist. He then rose in the ranks. He became the chair of psychiatry at the medical school and the psychiatrist-in-chief at the hospital. And in the 1970s, he asked his colleagues to conduct a study on what the long-term outcomes had been for the patients at Hopkins who had had sex reassignment procedures. And once he had the results of those studies, he was able to persuade the leadership of the hospital to shut down the sex reassignment clinic. Dr. McHugh thought it was a fundamental misdirection of medicine, that it was trying to solve a psychosocial problem through physical technique. And so it wasn't actually addressing the root problem. The problem wasn't with the body. The problem was with the thoughts and with the feelings. And so the therapy should be directed at the thoughts and the feelings. McHugh thought by having the elite, prestigious Johns Hopkins shut down their sex reassignment clinic, this would be an end to it. And at first it was. Many other institutions followed the lead of Johns Hopkins. The Johns Hopkins clinic remained shut down until 2 years ago when it was reopened, not in light of new scientific data. Human nature hasn't changed in the past generation. It was reopened in light of political pressure, particularly from the Human Rights Campaign, which was docking Johns Hopkins on their health equality index. But it's not just that Hopkins had reopened this 10 years ago, now 11 years ago. Boston Children's Hospital became, and I want to quote this because they actually brag about it on their website, quote, "the first major program in the United States to focus on transgender children and adolescents." That was 11 years ago. Today, more than a decade later, there are now 45 pediatric gender clinics. And at these clinics, parents are told that puberty-blocking drugs and cross-sex hormones may be the only way that they can prevent their child from committing suicide. Never mind that the best studies on gender dysphoria in children show that somewhere between 80 to 95% of young people who experience a gender identity conflict will naturally grow out of it if their development isn't interfered with. So the vast, vast majority of the time, if you just allow a child to continue maturing, they'll reconcile their identity with their body. Never mind for adults who identify as transgender, 41% of them will attempt suicide at some point in their lives. And for those adults who have had sex reassignment procedures, they're 19 times more likely to die by suicide. Those statistics are tragic, and it should immediately caution us to not embrace this rush into encouraging young people to transition. When you know what the outcomes are for adults identifying as transgender, why would you want to encourage a young person into that identity? Especially when you know that 80 to 95% of the time, they would simply naturally reconcile with their bodily identities. And so what I want to do this morning is kind of do a brief summary of some of the arguments that are contained in the book. And I want to start by thinking through what are the transgender activists proposing? The beginning point in any good response is actually understanding what the left is saying on these things. And so I'm going to go through a couple of steps of what transgender activists think about human nature, what they think about medicine, and then what they think about public policy. And then I'm going to turn to say, how should we evaluate this? What should we think about the philosophy? What should we think about the science? What should we think about the medicine? Trying to equip you to better understand what's going on. So let me start by saying people like to claim that we live in a postmodern era that has rejected metaphysics. Metaphysics being the philosopher's big word for kind of like the study of what is, the study of being, the study of nature. And that's not quite true. We live in a postmodern era that proposes a different metaphysic. We're still making truth claims. We're still making claims about reality. It's just that we're turning those claims upside down. And so at the heart of this transgender moment that we're living in are radical claims about human nature, radical claims about the human person. And the claim right now is that a boy who identifies as a girl is a girl. They say that person is a trans girl. It's not that it's a boy who identifies as a girl. They were willing to say that just 5 years ago. As I was doing research for the book, I was reading through some of the documents that LGBT groups had put out a decade ago, 5 years ago, and they used to say that a transgender man is a woman who identifies as a man. A transgender woman is a man who identifies as a woman. No more. Caitlyn Jenner is a woman. And if you say otherwise, you will be accused of hate speech. You will be accused of a thought crime. Right? That's a metaphysical claim to say that Caitlyn is a woman. And they're not debating this at the level of metaphysics, at the level of philosophy and theology, because in our culture, the high priests aren't the philosophers and the theologians. In our culture, the high priests are the doctors and the scientists. So they're dressing up a philosophical claim as if it's a medical and scientific claim. Because if you have the letters MD after your name and if you wear a white lab coat, that gets you credibility in our culture. If you have a PhD in metaphysics, that doesn't get you credibility. So let me give you an example of this. So I'm going to advance to the first slide here. This is Dr. Deanna Atkins. She's the director of the Child and Adolescent Gender Care Clinic at Duke University. Duke's a rather prestigious medical school. If you lived in the Carolinas and you wanted the best care for your child, this may be where you would go. This may be the physician whom you would see. She says, from a medical perspective, the appropriate determinant of sex is gender identity. It is counter to medical science to use chromosomes, hormones, internal reproductive organs, external genitalia, or secondary sex characteristics to override gender identity for purposes of classifying someone as male or female. Dr. Atkins made this claim as an expert witness in a federal court when the federal government sued the state of North Carolina because they didn't want to go along with gender ideology. So this is an expert witness in a federal court, and it's a remarkable claim, partly because just a generation ago we were told that sex was merely a biological reality and that gender was a social construct. The second wave feminists were trying to drive a wedge between sex and gender, saying sex is merely physical, gender is a social construct. Now we're being told that your gender identity determines your sex. Just 5 years ago, if you were a medical student, heck, if you were a high school biology student, the bread and butter of biology were things like chromosomes, hormones, internal organs, external genitalia, and secondary sex characteristics. Today, we're told that all of those aspects of objective reality are counter to medical science if they conflict with someone's subjective identity. And this is a claim being advanced in a court of law. It's also taking place not just in courtrooms, but in classrooms. So this next slide, it's the gender-bred person. This and the following graphic are being used in classrooms all across the United States. You should ask your children if this is being used in Cleveland public schools, if it's being used in other parts of Ohio. Aaron Baer will probably be able to fill you in on that later today when he speaks. But I've spoken now on four different continents on this topic, and at each place where I've spoken, parents have told me this graphic and the next one are being used at their child's schools. And what they're doing is they're indoctrinating children into how to think about their own bodies. The genderbred person that we says we have five different aspects of our sexual identity. All five of them exist along spectrums. That's why you're seeing the rainbow color arrows, the blue arrows for gender identity, the yellow arrows for gender expression, purple for biological sex, and then they have two different shades of red or orange. It doesn't quite pick it up on the slide. One for romantic attractions, one for sexual attractions. And so young people are being told, look, you have these five different aspects of your identity, and you need to decide where you fall on these various spectrums. Nothing is given. Nothing is created. It's not as if you've been created male and female, where male and female are created for each other. It's all a blank slate. And so you need to figure out what's your gender identity, what's your gender expression, what's your biological sex, which even here exists along spectra, which is why you see those arrows. What's your sexual attraction and what's your romantic attraction? Those things need not line up. You might have romantic attractions in one direction, sexual attractions in a different direction. Now, the genderbred person, you'll notice this graphic is version 3.3. It's the most up-to-date iteration of the genderbred person. The genderbred person got in trouble, and so it's now considered politically incorrect to use the genderbred person. The genderbred person got in trouble for two reasons. The first is the genderbred person was accused of supporting the patriarchy because he looks like a man. He looks like a gingerbread man. The second reason is that the graphic uses what's now considered an outdated term. It uses the phrase biological sex, which is now a no-no. So the new graphic that's being used is the gender unicorn. And you'll notice the two biggest changes are that the body is now neither discernibly male or female. In fact, they picked a mythical creature to embody their worldview. Which is oddly fitting that they would choose a unicorn to suggest that this is what they think is the truth about human nature. And then you'll notice that it now says sex assigned at birth. No longer is it a biological reality, biological sex. Now it's merely something that a doctor assigned to you at birth. Why does this matter? If you indoctrinate a generation of young people to believe their sex was merely assigned at birth, they're more likely to believe that later in life it could be reassigned. Why does this matter for children? I imagine when anyone in this room sees this graphic, you're not moved by it. It doesn't persuade you. But if you're a child, this graphic is meant to appeal to you, not to me. This is meant to appeal to our children and our grandchildren. The graphic looks like Barney. It's a bright, colorful, purple dinosaur, in this case, unicorn. It's meant to capture their moral imagination. It's meant to catechize them. And so imagine this same fifth grade boy who feels uncomfortable in his own body. And the one boy has been catechized to believe that he's been created by a loving God, created male and female. And the other child has been catechized to believe that his sex was merely assigned at birth and that it can be reassigned later in life because his gender identity is what's really important for his reality. Those two children are going to interpret their own thoughts and feelings and experiences in radically different ways, as will their parents and their doctors and their teachers and their counselors. Depending on which worldview you have, basic Genesis worldview or a gender unicorn worldview, the same exact situation, the same experiences, the same thoughts and feelings can be interpreted in radically different ways. And then it can be responded to in radically different ways. That's why the left is so intent on making sure that the gender unicorn is used in classrooms across the country so that they can be the ones that catechize your children and your grandchildren into how to think about their own bodies and their own identities. In fact, in this next slide, they explain why they use the new phrase, sex assigned at birth. They claim that biological sex is an ambiguous word that has no scale and no meaning, besides that it is related to some sex characteristics. It's also harmful to trans people. Instead, we prefer sex assigned at birth, which provides a more accurate description of what biological sex may be trying to communicate. This is their defense of the ideological language that's being used to indoctrinate children. Now, from this vision of the human person, this view of human nature gives rise to a certain medical treatment protocol. And so I just want to quickly go through what is now the standards of care for a child with gender dysphoria. And it's a four-part standard of care where the first step is a child as young as 2 or 3 years old, if he or she is persistent, insistent, and consistent, that they're the opposite sex, they should be allowed to have a new name and a new pronoun and a new wardrobe and access to new bathrooms and locker rooms and sports teams. The first step is called social transition, where you transition your child socially by having them live as if the opposite sex. And you can Google the Washington Post, the LA Times, various news stories that have been written on children ages 4, 5, 6 who have socially transitioned into living as the opposite sex. The second stage is that as that child now approaches puberty, they should be prevented from going through puberty in the, quote, wrong body. So doctors prescribe puberty-blocking drugs to 9, 10, 11-year-olds to trap them in that immature body, to prevent them from maturing along a natural pathway where a boy would develop into a man or a girl into a woman. This then sets up the third step, because now you have a teenager who is trapped in that child's body. And so they try to initiate and imitate and mimic the opposite sex's puberty, the gender identity puberty, by prescribing synthetic testosterone to teenage girls and synthetic estrogen to teenage boys to masculinize or feminize their bodies, not in accordance with their biology, but in accordance with their gender identity, which then sets up the fourth step, which the current recommendations are at age 18, but increasingly this is happening at younger ages, age 16. In one study, it was revealed that there were two 13-year-old girls who had had double mastectomies as part of their treatment protocol. That fourth step is surgical reassignment, where you can have various levels of surgical reassignment. You can have top surgery, as it's called, bottom surgery, procedures that would remove secondary sex characteristics, external genitalia, internal reproductive organs, and then use cosmetic surgery, plastic surgery, to try to create body parts that resemble the opposite sex. And so this is the current standard of care. And you might wonder why they're starting so young. Why are you allowing a 3 or 4 or 5-year-old to say what their true gender identity is? Why are you blocking puberty? Why are you administering cross-sex hormones to a teenager? Dr. Scott Leibowitz explains in his expert declaration in that same federal court case, peer-reviewed research demonstrates that pre-pubertal children asserting a different gender identity from the one they were assigned at birth are cognitively capable enough to be aware of the gender they are asserting. The meaning of a child's gender identity assertion at a younger age is no less valid than the meaning of a gender identity assertion of an older child. We should just believe the child, that they're cognitively capable enough. And let me just pause here to say, feel free to take pictures of these slides. I see some of you have pulled out your iPhones. Feel free to do that. If you want the full citations, everything that's on the PowerPoint is in the book, and there are like 30 pages of endnotes at the back of the book that'll give you the full citations to any of these quotes. So either way, feel free to do what's going to be most helpful for you. This is meant to give you lots of information, things that you can use to better understand this. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip the next slide and then the next slide and go to this slide here. This is from Diana Arasoff. She's the director of mental health at the Child and Adolescent Gender Center at the Children's Hospital for the University of California, San Francisco. So if you're living in the Bay Area and you have a child struggling with his or her gender identity, this is the doctor who you could be seeing. And this is what she says in reference to a child with a gender identity struggle. They refuse to pin themselves down as either male or female. Maybe they are a boy-girl or a gender hybrid or gender ambidextrous, moving freely between genders, living somewhere in between, or creating their own mosaic of gender identity and expression. As they grow older, they might identify themselves as agender, or gender neutral, or gender queer. Each one of these children is exercising their gender creativity. We can think of them as our gender creative children. Now, what's remarkable about this quote, and it's in a handbook that was put out for parents of LGBT children, is that Dr. Ehrensoft is one of the leading supporters, promoters, endorsers of that four-part standard of care, including the puberty-blocking drugs, the cross-sex hormones, and the surgery. And so even as she recommends radical interventions that will permanently change a young person's body, she also acknowledges that, quote, as they grow older, their gender identity might change. So why would a physician recommend radical, permanent, life-altering transformation on someone's body while knowing that their identity might change? And how do you even make those physical alterations for someone who is a boy-girl or a gender hybrid or gender ambidextrous? What does that even, what do those words mean? And what would the medical treatment look like to conform someone's body to those identities? Right? There's some deep problems here. Let me quickly go through the public policy, and I just want to mention four aspects of the policy. The first is, what will be taught in schools, especially government-run, misnamed as public schools? What will be taught to young people as the truth about sex and gender and body and identity? Will they be taught actual truths about their bodies, or will they be taught the gender unicorn? And that's something we need to be concerned about. What's happening at the local public schools? What's happening at the state house with respect to this? Second is, how will access to sex-specific facilities be governed? Will they be governed on the basis of biology, where we have separate male and female spaces because of the biological, anatomical, physiological differences between males and females? Or will they be governed based on identity, where because some people wear dresses and some people wear suits, that we have separate facilities? And so if you identify as a woman, you have access to the women's restroom, locker room, shower, and sports teams. Third, how will we govern what speech must be spoken? In New York City right now, you can be fined $250,000 for intentionally misgendering someone. So if you fail to use someone's preferred pronouns, will you run afoul of the law? And then fourthly, how will the provision of medical services be regulated? And this has two aspects. One is, will bad medicine be mandated? That Obamacare mandate that I mentioned said that all relevant medical institutions and physicians would have to perform reassignment procedures. So if you're an endocrinologist that does testosterone therapy for men with low testosterone, you would have to do it for women who want to identify as men. Otherwise, you'd be guilty of discrimination. If you're a surgeon who performs double mastectomies in the case of breast cancer, but you decline to perform it in the case of a woman or even a teenage girl who wants to identify as a man, you would be guilty of discrimination. Right now, there are two Catholic hospitals being sued because they have declined to perform hysterectomies on women who want to identify as men. And their response is that we don't perform unnecessary medicine. If you have a healthy, functioning uterus, we won't be removing it because we think it's bad medicine. There's nothing wrong with your body. And they're being sued for discrimination under state anti-discrimination law. So that's one question. Will bad medicine be mandated? Will it be possible to be a Hippocratic physician? First, do no harm. The second question is, will good medicine be prohibited? Already now I've lost count if it's 13, 14, or 15 states have banned what they call conversion therapy. And by conversion therapy, they don't just mean truly abhorrent practices like electroshock therapy for people with same-sex attractions. What they mean is any talk therapy at all that would help someone with same-sex attractions not act on those attractions, or help someone with gender dysphoria identify with their bodies. So right now, if Dr. McHugh was to practice medicine with a minor, in one of those states, let's say there was a boy who was identifying as a girl, felt uncomfortable being a boy, and Dr. McHugh was simply to talk to that child to try to figure out what it was about being a boy that he found problematic, what it was about being a girl that he found a solution to his problems, Dr. McHugh could lose his medical license. Okay? Which also means as parents, you lack options in certain states. If you want your child who is struggling with a gender identity conflict to receive professional assistance in reconciling his or her identity with reality, you may be without options in the state where you live. Right. So those are going to be the policy questions. I'm going to skip the next slide in the sake of time, just go to this one. This is something for the schools. Ultimately, the school environment must be set up so that transgender girls are treated like all other girls. Now remember, what is a transgender girl? It's a boy who identifies as a girl. This is a handbook that was produced by the ACLU, the Human Rights Campaign, Gender Spectrum, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the National Education Association. So the largest teachers union in America partnered with a left-wing law firm and with three LGBT activist groups to produce the handbook on how schools should handle transitioning students. And their bottom line is that boys who identify as girls must be treated like all other girls when it comes to bathrooms, locker rooms, sports teams. You might have seen just 2 weeks ago there was a track competition where the number one and the number two finisher were boys identifying as girls. There are reasons why we have separate athletic competitions for men and women, for boys and girls. And it's not our identities. It's not the clothes that we wear or the makeup that we wear. It's our biologies. It's our bodies. We have bodily differences, which is why we have separate competitions. Most alarming to me as a new parent was this next quote, privacy and confidentiality are critically important for transgender students who do not have supportive families. In those situations, even inadvertent disclosures could put the student in a potentially dangerous situation at home, so it's important to have a plan in place to help avoid any mistakes or slip-ups. There was an entire appendix to one of the reports on how a school could help a child transition at school without the parents knowing about it. How the school could have a separate wardrobe waiting in the guidance counselor's office, how there could be two sets of records, one that used the given name and the appropriate pronouns that would be sent home to mom and dad, and then one that would use the new name and the new pronouns internally. The privacy and confidentiality of the student against his or her mom and dad. And you all probably know that already in the state of Ohio, parents have lost custody of their teenage daughter because they didn't want her receiving testosterone therapy. I thought the first time we would see a case like that, it would happen in California or New York or Massachusetts. It happened outside of Columbus. Right? It's happened right here in Ohio. Aaron Baer can talk to you more about that. All right, so those are the challenges. That is what's confronting us. Many people want to ignore this. They want to keep their head in the sand. They want to wish that if they just don't think about it, it'll go away. And that's not going to happen. We have to know what's going on, what's being proposed, so that we can respond. Let me quickly go through how to think about this. And I want to first go through some of the philosophy, some of the science, and then some of the medicine. The first thing to say about the philosophy is that it is riddled with contradictions, where they say on the one hand X and on the other hand not X. That as you read more and more of the transgender literature, they're trying to have it both ways, which suggests that there's something fundamentally flawed with their metaphysics, with their worldview. They're getting human nature wrong. As I think about this, it looks to me like it's a combination of the ancient philosophy of Gnosticism, in which the real self is something other than the body, while they simultaneously embrace materialism, in which only material bodies exist. When you look at who the activists are who are pushing this, they're all materialists, and yet they want to say that the real self could be trapped in the wrong body. Who or what is that real self which is trapped in the wrong body? They can't answer. There's a dualism going on here, a metaphysical Gnostic dualism, rather than viewing us as soul-body unities. The second is that it actually relies on rigid sex stereotypes, you know, where girls play with dolls and boys play with trucks, while it insists that gender is merely a social construct. And so it says that the facts of our biology are irrelevant, but our gender identity is super relevant. You can't have it both ways. If gender is a social construct, how can gender identity be innate and immutable and somehow meaningful? And so let me ask you just two questions, maybe three depending on time, to elucidate this. What does it feel like to feel like a woman? Are all of the women in this room this morning feeling the same way? Is that what makes you all part of the class known as woman? And have you talked to each other to see if you all have the same feeling? Right? Because the idea here is that gender identity is an internal sense of gender. What does gender feel like? What does it feel like to feel like a woman? How would I know if I felt like a woman? Which is why so frequently it doubles down on sex stereotypes. This is one reason why many feminists are very frustrated with transgender activists. When Bruce becomes Caitlin, he doubles down on all of these stereotypes about what it means to be a woman. Red lipstick, high heels, cleavage, right? The Vanity Fair cover image is the stereotypical pinup model. Is that what it feels like to feel like a woman? Is that the internal sense of womanhood, of womanness? So there's both there's a metaphysical question, an ontological question of what is this thing known as gender identity? And then there's also an epistemological question, epistemology being the philosopher's big word for knowledge. How would I know what it is to feel like a woman? I don't have access to that knowledge. So even if we know what it is to feel like a woman, how would I know that? I don't have access to a woman's body. And then to go back to the ontology, why should feeling like a woman, whatever that is, make someone a woman? Right? Our feelings, our thoughts could be misguided. Very few were the people who went along with Rachel Dolezal, the white woman who felt like she was black, who was running an NAACP chapter on the West Coast. Do any of you remember this? It's about 3 years ago. There was a white lady who was running an NAACP. No one said, oh, she's transracial, right? Her internal sense of race is that she's, what does it feel like to feel like you're black, right? And to even ask the question is to immediately say, you're going to answer that question with a bunch of stereotypes. And that's exactly what's happening here. What does it feel like a woman? You're going to answer it with a bunch of stereotypes. Especially when little boys don't feel like boys and feel like girls, it's almost always coming from a bad cultural stereotype. I'm going to close with some examples of that. So philosophically, there's some problems here, both the ontology, metaphysical side, and the epistemology side. And so it's not surprising that once you get the philosophy of human nature wrong, you're also going to get some of the medicine, some of the science wrong. And so contrary to what the activists claim, sex isn't assigned at birth. And that's why it can't be reassigned later in life. Sex reassignment procedures fail on the very first level at even physically reassigning sex because sex can't be reassigned. The sex of an individual is built into our bodies from the very first moment of our existence. From the chromosomes that we inherit from our mother and our father, that sperm and that egg, and whether they carry X or Y chromosomes. Those chromosomes then give rise to the development of certain internal reproductive organs, which then start to produce certain hormones, which then lead to the development of certain external genitalia, and then eventually secondary sex characteristics. Almost all of that begins taking place well before 20 weeks in utero. Which is why when you go in for your 20-week ultrasound, the ultrasound technician can tell you if you're having a boy or a girl. Now, this doesn't mean that sex is assigned at ultrasound. And it's not like, oh, so it's just the problem. It's just not assigned at birth. It's assigned at ultrasound. No, sex can be discerned. Sex can be recognized well prior to birth. It can be discerned on a grainy ultrasound screen. It can be discerned in this ballroom. We can look at each other and discern whether we're talking to a man or a woman based upon how the body is organized. And the same thing is true in utero. The body starts organizing him or herself from day one in utero. It develops certain reproductive organs, certain hormones, certain external genitalia, certain secondary sex characteristics. If you notice what I'm reciting, it's that list of things that Dr. Adkins says is counter to medical science. These are what defines us, not just human beings, but across the animal kingdom as male or female. There are two different ways that animal bodies are organized with respect to sexual reproduction. There are two different sexual reproductive systems. There are two different sex organs. There are two different sets of sex chromosomes. There are two different sexual gametes, sperm and egg. This is why there's a sexual binary. It doesn't exist along a spectrum. It's not fluid. There are male and there's female. There are also people who have disorders of sexual development. Less than 1% of the population is born with a disorder of sexual development, which sometimes has been called an intersex condition or a hermaphrodite condition. That's not a third sex. There's not a third reproductive system. There's not a third gamete. There's not a third set of sex chromosomes. But like anything else in developmental biology, our development can go off tracks. People can have various forms of disease or disability, and it doesn't change the underlying reality. So you could have an incompletely developed male reproductive system or female reproductive system. And doctors have been diagnosing and treating these conditions for centuries. Parents have been raising children with disorders of sexual development for centuries. And it has nothing to do with gender dysphoria or transgender identities. The gender dysphoria and transgender identities frequently happen with people who have fully developed sexual capacities but who have an identity that doesn't align with their sexual bodies. This also can explain why sex reassignment procedures can't actually reassign sex. You can't go back and change the chromosomes in every cell of your body. You can't go back and change your sexual reproductive system. What you can do is mutilate your body by removing certain body parts and then using cosmetic plastic surgery to create appendages that resemble the opposite sex's body part. But that doesn't turn a man into a woman. It doesn't turn a woman into a man. It masculinizes a woman and it feminizes a man. So in these next quotes, you'll see Dr. Larry Mayer: scientifically speaking, transgender men are not biological men. Transgender women are not biological women. The claims to the contrary are not supported by a scintilla of scientific evidence. And then my co-author, Robert George at Princeton: changing sexes is a metaphysical impossibility because it is a biological impossibility. So from the bad philosophy of human nature, we then see that they're trying to do something that's impossible as a scientific physical matter. And that also can begin to help us understand why it doesn't resolve the underlying psychosocial struggles that people face. What the best science on this shows is that even when the reassignment procedures go well as a cosmetic matter, where people are happy with how they look, and even in cultures that are relatively trans-friendly, some of the European, Scandinavian countries, the medical evidence shows that people who identify as transgender still faced a host of elevated risks in life. Increased struggles with depression, with anxiety, with substance abuse, with alcoholism, with suicide ideation, with suicide attempts, and unfortunately even with completed death by suicide. Dr. McHugh helps explain in an essay that he wrote shortly after the Bruce Jenner 2020 interview. He writes, "Transgender men do not become women. Neither transgendered women become men. All, including Bruce Jenner, become feminized men or masculinized women, counterfeits or impersonators of the sex with which they identify. In that lies their problematic future. When the tumult and shouting dies, it proves not easy nor wise to live in a counterfeit sexual garb. The most thorough follow-up of sex reassigned people, extending over 30 years and conducted in Sweden, where the culture is strongly supportive of the transgender, documents their lifelong mental unrest. 10 to 15 years after surgical reassignment, the suicide rate of those who had undergone sex reassignment surgery rose to 20 times that of comparable peers. These were the realities that Dr. McHugh knew when he went to the administration at Johns Hopkins and convinced them to shut down the sex reassignment clinic back in the 70s, that we're not solving the underlying problems. Dr. McHugh would put this in two ways. He would say, first, imagine a patient population that is suffering so much that they would contemplate having reassignment procedures. Right? They're not faking this. They're not making it up. They're really suffering in their own bodies. And the solution that we're proposing doesn't address those underlying problems. Those underlying problems that led them to our doctor's office to begin with persist. And then second, we may have even made things worse for them because he says it proves not easy nor wise to live in counterfeit sexual garb. That it's very hard, especially 5, 10, 15 years down the road, to live as if the opposite sex. Which is why, as Dr. McHugh points out, it's 10 to 15 years after the surgical reassignment you see the spike in the suicide rates. Don't just believe Dr. McHugh. I'm going to run through a couple of slides giving you other evidence of this. Feel free to take pictures. The first one comes out of the United Kingdom 15 years ago. This is in 2004, back before the newspapers were self-censoring themselves, or even worse, were actively promoting the left's agenda. A Guardian Weekend, this is they're speaking about themselves in the third person. They Guardian Weekend asked Birmingham University's Aggressive Research Intelligence Facility, ARIF, to assess the findings of more than 100 follow-up studies of post-op transsexuals. ARIF, which conducts reviews of healthcare treatments for the NHS, concludes that none of the studies provides conclusive evidence that gender reassignment is beneficial for patients. It found that most research was poorly designed, which skewed the results in favor of physically changing sex. There was no evaluation of whether other treatments, such as long-term counseling, might help transsexuals or whether their gender confusion might lessen over time. So 15 years ago, The Guardian and Birmingham University was willing to point out that with over 100 follow-up studies of post-op transsexuals, none of them provided conclusive evidence that this was actually beneficial to the patients, and that the studies were really poorly designed, many of them lacking follow-up, lacking confirmatory control groups, lacking any consideration of whether other therapies might have worked better, that the people conducting the studies frequently have a vested interest in the outcomes of the studies. That was in 2004, 10 years later in 2014, so just 5 years ago, Hazen Corporation. They're a medical consulting company. Hospitals, doctor's office, healthcare plans use them to figure out which medical technologies are safe, which ones are unsafe, which should be covered on a healthcare plan, which should be offered at a hospital. And this is what they reported. Statistically significant improvements have not been consistently demonstrated by multiple studies for most outcomes. Evidence regarding quality of life and function was very sparse. Evidence for less comprehensive measures of well-being, which was directly applicable to gender dysphoria patients, was sparse and or conflicting. The study designs do not permit conclusions of causality, and studies generally had weaknesses associated with the execution. There were potentially long-term safety risks, but none have been proven or ruled out. So what Hayes was pointing out just 5 years ago, this is all a giant experiment. And yet parents are being told that the science is settled, that you have to do this to your child, otherwise your child will harm themselves. Parents have already lost custody of their child in this state because they didn't want to go along with this giant experiment. If you don't believe Dr. McHugh, if you don't believe Hayes, if you don't believe Birmingham University and the Guardian newspaper, would you believe the Obama administration? And this isn't a trick question. In this case, you can. In 2016, so this is after they had issued their transgender mandate to private healthcare plans, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Studies refused to force all of the state Medicare and Medicare plans to cover sex reassignment procedures. This is what they wrote. This is their proposed decision memo, which came out in June of 2016. Based on a thorough review of the clinical evidence available at this time, there is not enough evidence to determine whether reassignment procedures improve health outcomes for Medicare beneficiaries. There are conflicting, inconsistent study results. Of the best designed studies, some reported benefits while others reported harms. The quality and strength of evidence were low due to the mostly observational study designs with no comparison groups, potential confounding, small sample sizes. Many studies that reported positive outcomes were exploratory studies, case studies, with no confirmatory follow-up. So that was the Obama administration in 2016, their proposed memo. The final memo came out 3 months later, 2 months later in August, and you can just see the quote here. I won't read it for the sake of time. It more or less just repeats all of the flaws in the study designs. Small sample sizes, no confirmatory follow-up, no long-term investigation, a lack of validated metrics, so you're just doing self-reports, confounding of causes, et cetera, et cetera. And then this next slide, I want to start it right from the middle. After careful assessment, we identified 6 studies that could provide useful information. Of these, the 4 best designed and conducted studies that assessed quality of life before and after surgery did not demonstrate clinically significant changes or differences in psychometric test results after GRS, gender reassignment surgery. So first, they're going to say that out of all these hundreds of studies, only 6 of them could actually be useful, which just shows you how experimental and how bad the science is on this. And then of the 4 best studies that exist, none of them show clinically significant changes after the sex reassignment procedures. So imagine that you're that patient who is suffering, suffering so badly that you would contemplate removing various body parts, and then after the surgery, there's no clinically significant change. All of those same things that brought you to the doctor's office, the anxiety, the depression, the alienation from your own body, the suicide ideation, the alcoholism, the substance abuse, no clinically significant change. They don't improve. Which is why in this next slide, they discuss that Swedish study that Dr. McHugh had discussed. And I just want to start with the second sentence. The mortality was primarily due to completed suicides. We note mortality from this patient population did not become apparent until after 10 years. One of the things that worries a lot of researchers right now is that when the media talks about how great sex reassignment procedures are, they're looking 1 or 2 or 3 years after the procedure. They have snapshot studies that will follow up with a patient a year after surgery and saying, how is your life going? And they'll say, it's going great. And then the media will say, you know, sex reassignment benefits patients. They aren't looking 10, 15 years down the road, which is when the long-term studies, a few of which actually exist, show that many of the problems begin to have consequences.
You have been listening to Ryan T. Anderson, the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and the founder and editor-in-chief of Public Discourse and presenter at the 2019 Bringing America Back to Life Convention.
From the Median is listener-supported. Visit our website, fromthemedian.org, for further information or to make a donation to continue to make this radio program possible. Email us, radionews@fromthemedian.org, or call 440-668-4049. Through our fromthemedian.org website, you can download this or previous programs for your listening pleasure or sign up to receive our weekly preview of upcoming guest interviews. Tune in every weeknight at the same time to listen to another great interview on From the Median as we plan the route that takes us back to the culture of life. From the Median is brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.